Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, this is Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. Today I was pleased to interview Professor Dorian Abbott. Dorian is a professor of geophysical sciences at the University of Chicago. He, together with Professor Marinovich from Stanford University, penned a piece in Newsweek, the host of this podcast. It was an opinion piece, where they opened their piece by saying that American universities are undergoing a profound transformation that threatens to derail their primary mission, the production and dissemination of knowledge. Because of that piece, he was disinvited from the annual John Carlson lecture at MIT. There was a reaction from some of the student body about his opinions relating to affirmative action, diversity, inclusion initiatives in higher education. Obviously an important topic, a hot topic these days. I think you'll find this podcast informative. Take a listen. My name is Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. I'm really pleased today to be joined by Professor Abbott. Professor Abbott, you're a geophysical science professor at the University of Chicago. In September, you were disinvited from the annual John Carlson lecture at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology after there was a backlash from MIT's student body over your public opinions regarding diversity, affirmative action, inclusion initiatives, and higher education. It seems you started the controversy with an opinion piece that was published by you and Professor Ivan Marinovich, a professor at Stanford University, published by Newsweek. As I said, Newsweek happens to be the host of this podcast. The title of the opinion piece was "The Diversity Problem on Campus." You opened your opinion piece with a statement, "American universities are undergoing a profound transformation that threatens to derail their primary mission, the production and dissemination of knowledge." Seems like a great place to start. Why don't you give us the background on, you know, where this piece came from, why you wrote it, and then we'll get into the controversy.
Great. Yeah. One point I wanted to address from that intro, though, is this wasn't the whole student body of MIT. This was a committed group of activists, small in number, and was not exclusively people at MIT. In fact, one of the main activists was a professor at Williams College with no current connection to MIT. So that's important for people to understand, because sometimes these issues get framed like all young people are crazy nowadays. And my experience as a teacher and interacting with young people is that that's not true. There's a small number of bad actors, and there's a lot of people just keeping their mouths shut and afraid of getting it next if they say anything. So the general background of that essay was, I guess maybe 5 years ago, 2016, in that range, I started self-censoring on campus and noticing that I was doing this and being uncomfortable about it. And around that time, I heard about the Heterodox Academy and joined it, which is something Jonathan Haidt started, which is a group, it's a very nice group that promotes academic freedom and free speech principles on campus. It's a nice group because it's one of the only groups in the academy that is really completely politically neutral. So it's one of people who give their political affiliation when asked. It's one third conservative, one third moderate, and one third liberal, which is rare in an academic context. And I joined this group and read their literature and followed it. And it was something that I was concerned about, but not willing to speak openly about. And then we had, 2020, sort of the terrible year of 2020 with the riots and people in broad swaths of society censoring themselves and the sort of witch hunt atmosphere. And it was in that context that I decided, I'm a 40-year-old professor professor, tenured professor at the University of Chicago, and I can't just stay silent on these issues. I have a sort of a moral duty to speak openly, even if I'm wrong, to give my true opinion. And so in the fall of 2020, I made some statements publicly within the context of my department about treating people equally, not discriminating against people, listening to other people, even if you disagree with them, things like this. And there was a backlash, and it led to a Twitter storm and a letter of denunciation that was signed by a number of students and postdocs. And this ultimately, what happened in this situation was the president of the university, President Zimmer at the time, issued a statement saying that we encourage our faculty to speak on a wide variety of topics in whatever format they want, and we don't punish them for doing that. And that sort of killed that issue, which shows how important leadership is in these type of events. But as a result of that, Ivan Marinovich from Stanford reached out to me, and we started having conversations. And he runs a seminar series called the Classical Liberalism Seminar Series at Stanford. And at the time, it was all on Zoom. Now some of them are happening in person. But he just invites people from a broad range of intellectual perspectives to come give lectures, but all people who agree in freedom of expression and testing the boundaries of knowledge and not sort of submitting to orthodoxies and limiting what we think about. And it was a great environment. It's still going. It's been a great environment where up to 50 professors from around the country show up on Zoom, and he organizes some speaker on any topic. Often it's controversial, and everyone there knows that they can say whatever they think, and no one's going to try to punish them for that. And so it's been a really refreshing atmosphere. And last summer, Ivan had written an email that he was going to send to the entire business school, sort of laying out his concerns with some of the DEI stuff that had been happening. And we sort of discussed it and decided it would be better to write that as an op-ed and just be open about it to everyone. And so that's where that came from. And so we worked on it together, developed the ideas.
Look, very courageous. You know, you talk about good leadership. So it's interesting to me, you have the leadership then at the University of Chicago, Professor Marinovich at a university I wouldn't think would necessarily embrace this kind of openness. So I'm super excited to hear that. And then you have leadership at MIT that, in my view, correct me if I'm wrong, kind of caved to this mob mentality, small mob though it may have been. Thank you for clarifying that in your opening remarks. If you had to guess across the country what the trend is the trend more leaning toward MIT and students are fearful of opening their mouths and professors are fearful of opening their mouths? Or would you think that maybe Chicago and Stanford are hopefully going to be the example for all? Because what's a university for other than airing opinions and talking about them and educating, inspiring, and not boycotting, I guess, is probably the best way I could describe it.
Yeah, so we don't have to guess because we have the data. And so the best place I can direct your listeners to is a report by a political scientist, social scientist named Eric Kaufman, which I call the iceberg report on cancellations and their effect. And so what he found in this report was of active faculty, only about 3 in 10,000 are canceled each year. And a cancellation here refers to something like what happened to me, a lecture canceled, a paper withdrawn, or the loss of jobs or significant punishment from one of these outrage incidences. However, the effect is that among centrist and conservative faculty, 1 in 4 have been threatened with disciplinary action just for their speech. 1 in 3 have been bullied for their beliefs. 1 in 2 have been put under psychological pressure for their beliefs. And 9 in 10 say that a supporter of President Trump could not express his or her views on campus. And after the incident at MIT, MIT polled its faculty and found that 83% say that their and their colleagues' voices are increasingly in jeopardy on campus, and that 60% feel that their and their colleagues' voices are constrained on an everyday basis at MIT. And so we don't really have to guess. We know that the choice MIT made is what's more common in this sphere.
So this topic is just particularly interesting to me for two reasons. One, of my six kids, four are university age, college slash grad school age. Two, I did work for the Trump administration. I spoke in front of thousands of people worldwide, right? And as you can imagine, and in particular, the file I worked on was very controversial. So I spoke in front of very pro-Trump audiences, pro our policies in the White House relating to the Middle East, and many who were absolutely dead set against Trump and our policies, many in the Arab capitals and so on and so forth. But I will say, among the thousands and thousands of people I spoke to, I only got yelled at, maybe is the right way to describe it, twice. So I had a pretty good track record, and I'm shocked and disappointed that this is what's happening on college campuses. So what does it mean for the education my kids and everybody's kids who are at university level are getting? Are they really getting an education, or are they getting an indoctrination?
I don't want to speak generally. I think there are a lot of places that are trying hard to give an education and a lot of faculty that are trying hard to give an education. But there are some who are trying to indoctrinate. There's no question. And so the language that would be used would be social justice activism. So they wouldn't say we want to indoctrinate. They would say we think that the highest ideal of a university is not the production of new knowledge. It's activism in an effort to affect social justice in society. And so that's how it would be framed. And that's increasingly common. And I've had students tell me that even at the University of Chicago, that they have professors in the humanities who will give them grades and say, one student told me, for example, you're not going to get higher. The professor wrote on the essay, you're not going to get higher than a C unless you acknowledge the existence of systemic racism. So it's fairly explicit that you have to parrot back the ideological viewpoint of certain faculty in order to advance. Now, you know, there are merits to the idea of systemic racism and demerits, but we have to allow people to argue the opposite side if we want to get at the truth.
So let's take it beyond university then. What does it mean for our society, for our workplace, corporate diversity policies? You know, how do we go from here if, whether it's a small number of universities, a larger number of universities, if our young adults are coming out of the university systems having been indoctrinated, and thank you for pointing out, you know, we don't want to talk broadly, but with a decent number of students being indoctrinated, what does that mean in the workplace?
Well, so we have to draw a distinction between a university and a company. So I'm not an expert on companies, not having ever been employed by a company, but they have specific goals of maximizing profit for their shareholders. And their goal of their institution is not the advancement of human knowledge. And it may be that as long as they operate within certain legal frameworks, they might say, look, if you want to work at this company, you've got to buy into the following vision. And perhaps that's okay. I certainly don't object to it necessarily. What I object to is somewhere like Google that claims that, you know, they're interested in the pursuit of truth and then specifically limits what their employees are allowed to say. But there has to be a complete distinction between that framework and the university framework, where we have the explicit goal of the unfettered pursuit of truth. And we can't have limitations on our speech built into the system if we're trying to pursue truth. Because ultimately what's going on is people are weaponizing them. So if they want to advance a certain political position or an activist goal, they can then try to disallow any speech that disagrees with their position. And that's what's happening on campus. And that's extremely important in a university context to not allow that kind of behavior.
In your op-ed, you talk about the new regime, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But then you suggest your view of replacing that with merit, fairness, and equality. Tell us about, you know, the current regime and why you, in some universities, and why you think yours is better.
Okay, so people should be aware that those words, diversity, equity, and inclusion, used in this context, they don't necessarily mean what you might think in an everyday context. The most important one is equity, which means fairness in terms of the dictionary definition. But the way it's being used on college campuses and now more broadly in society is equal outcome. And so essentially it's an effort to enforce group-based equal outcomes. So equal outcomes across different groups on almost any metric that you can come up with. And our criticism of that took sort of three routes. The first is that it's unethical because it treats human beings as instruments in order to affect group-based outcomes, desirable or claimed to be desirable social outcomes. So it doesn't treat them with an inherent and intrinsic dignity, human beings. It detracts from the core mission of a university, which is the production of knowledge. So it introduces alternative goals other than the production of knowledge, which can decrease your ability to produce knowledge. And it decreases the public's trust in universities. And the reason that we said that is that while 75% of the public, according to a recent Pew poll, agrees that diversity is important, 74% say that only job qualifications should be taken into account in hiring and promotion. And so if our universities are not acting in accordance with these fairness principles, then people are going to start to devalue the degrees coming out of them. And furthermore, most of the funding, even for private universities, is coming from public grants. And so we didn't want to just have a negative piece. We wanted to propose some sort of positive, pragmatic alternative. And we chose the words merit, fairness, and equality as sort of a trinity of values that could address some of these issues, but do them in a way that we didn't think was morally problematic. And so one aspect of that, of course, is getting rid of admissions and hiring decisions based on group membership. So not discriminating against people because, for example, they're Asian and we have too many Asian people on campus and too many, put too many in scare quotes in your mind, but that's the sort of logic that's going on. So not discriminating for those reasons, but also not discriminating because someone happens to be a legacy, which means that their parents went to the university, not discriminating on the basis of athletic admission. It turns out that legacy and athletic admissions go strongly disproportionately to white students. Also, there are issues in our society that not everyone has equal access to education. And so we advocated that universities develop programs to try to improve education, non-ideological programs where you can test different strategies without going in thinking you have the right answer, and then invest in them. If this is something they care about, invest in education so that we can do a fair evaluation on admissions and in faculty hiring.
Let's talk about men and women for a second. So I grew up at a time, I think, when men and women were equal. My law school graduating class was somewhere 50-50 men, women. You know, maybe it was high 40s for women, I don't remember. But it never even occurred to me to think, oh, you're a woman, you don't belong here, you're not as smart as me, you're not as talented as me. I started at a big law firm in the Wall Street area, same kind of thing. I don't remember how many men versus women, but it was, everything was normal. And if I fast forward to today, my wife's a doctor, one daughter studying medicine, one daughter will be studying medicine, one psychology, one's too young to make a decision. But did I miss the boat on discrimination? And I know there's lots of discrimination, Asian, Black, et cetera, but just to grasp men, women for a second, what happened from the time I thought society improved, everything was sort of like appropriate. How did we get to the point of you have to have quotas or anti-quotas or something like that?
I mean, at this point, it's actually, I think 60% of undergraduates are women. So women are actually doing much better at an undergraduate level. But I guess the question is broader than that. It's why are people talking about trying to do quotas instead of setting up a fair process so that anyone who works hard and is qualified can get through regardless of the characteristics that they're born with, racial, sexual, whatever. And so I think that transition has occurred over the past 5 to 10 years, and it's part of a movement that sometimes described as progressive, sometimes social justice, sometimes woke. And you can read people like Ibram X. Kendi And Robin DiAngelo, if you want to understand sort of the arguments for that movement and why they're making their case. Personally, I disagree with it, and I don't want to try to make their arguments for them or straw man them. But the reason that I disagree is, on a basic moral level, I think it's unethical to treat human beings as primarily a member of a given group rather than as individuals.
So it reminds me, at one point I was interviewing for a particular guest, I don't want to say who, on my podcast, and their PR team was on a call with me and asked, you know, for your guest, because they were interested in potentially giving me one of several people, for your guest, does it need to be male, female? And they went through several categories, and brand new question for me, to be honest. Like, I just never was put in that position before. And I knew where they were going, and I took a deep breath, and I guess I didn't know you at the time, and I didn't read your articles yet, but I channeled my Professor Abbott, and I said, I'm looking for somebody who could impart knowledge on my audience, who knows what they're saying, knows what they're doing, subject matter expert. I don't care how they identify themselves. And as the words came tumbling out of my mouth, I thought, well, now I blew it. Now they're not going to give me anyone for the show. But the person took a deep breath herself and said, great, we're on the same page, and they offered up a guest, and that was it. I wish it would be as simple as that in all conversations. I know that it's not. But do you find that if more people, you know, that was a small example for me and it was a private conversation, yours is obviously extremely public and I'm sure to some degree aggravating, annoying, painful. I'm not even sure how to describe it. You know, you did it on the big stage, if you will. Do you think if people of fairness, goodwill, however you want to describe them, can be willing to just fight back, if you will, against this group of the cancel culture mob, because I don't even know how big that mob truly is, that we could finally swing the pendulum in a fair way so it isn't constantly making students fear in certain classrooms, professors in certain universities fear, people looking for jobs or wanting to get into a school? Or do you think the mob mentality is just too strong?
Yeah, so I mentioned before this Pew poll that about 74% of Americans agree with this position that only qualifications should be taken into account in hiring and promotion. And that includes the majority of all races and of both political parties. And so it's important for people to understand that there really is a silent majority here that's being bullied by a very, very vocal and politically powerful minority using, for example, Twitter and other mechanisms as a force multiplier to sort of intimidate the decision maker and get them to make the political decision that this group wants for canceling a lecture, firing someone, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it does make a big difference when people say something publicly. Even a few people can stand up and say something publicly, and it can turn the tide within an organization. One example I want to point to is David Romps. Professor Romps was the director of the Berkeley Atmospheric Sciences and Climate Center. I forget if I got all the letters in the acronym exactly right, but in the wake of my disinvitation from MIT, he had a conversation with the faculty in this group and said, as a statement of our principle that we are a scientific institution and not a political institution, we should invite Dorian Abbott to come give his seminar that he would have given at MIT. And the response apparently within this faculty meeting was not only no, but we can never invite that guy ever again to Berkeley. You know, he's not welcome at Berkeley ever again.
Wow. That's crazy.
And so Professor Romps resigned. He wrote a little manifesto on Twitter and basically said, I signed up, you know, regardless of whether I agree or disagree with the points that Dorian Abbott is making, I'm speaking as David Romps right now. I did not sign up to lead a political institution. I signed up to lead a scientific institution. And I can't continue to be the director if that's how we're going to make decisions about who we bring in to give lectures. And so that ended up getting liked on Twitter, for what that's worth, more than 20,000 times and shared around. And I think that's the sort of thing that people who are in leadership roles can do to make a statement that they're not okay with this.
Well, good on him. That was courageous and obviously impactful to him in a very negative way, but good on him for being courageous. But then you had a different experience, I guess, with Princeton. What happened there?
Oh, yeah. So Professor George at Princeton is kind of a well-known actor on the academic freedom front. He's done a lot of work on this over the past 20 years. And he runs a program called the Madison Program at Princeton. And when he heard about this issue that I had had with the Carlson lecture, he just invited me to give the lecture at Princeton through the Madison program on the same day and via Zoom. See, it would have, the Carlson lecture would have been, you know, broadcast out for the public. It was designed for the public. I guess that's another point we should probably talk about. The topic of this lecture was numerical models of fluid flow and radiative transfer that can help us understand which planets outside the solar system orbiting different stars could potentially have liquid water and maybe be a host for life. So it had absolutely nothing to do, a totally technical talk. None of these issues were supposed to come up at all. And so, but Professor George asked me to give this talk, and I agreed, and I'm very thankful for that opportunity. I gave the talk on the day that the Carlson lecture was supposed to happen at MIT, and they told me that 4,400 people signed in to watch at least part of it. And so enough to fill, you know, a small stadium.
Like Donald Trump numbers.
Came to watch, you know, a highly technical science sort of a talk. I mean, it was for the public, but it was pretty nerdy sort of a talk. And, you know, I thought that was great. Some of them were probably there as a statement and some of them were interested and just heard about it. But I think it was a great sign that people are fed up with this kind of thing. And they just want to have a society where our science professors can do their science without being impeded by having to make ideological oaths.
Right. It's one thing if in the midst of your science lecture, you're saying all sorts of nasty things, untrue things, whatever. That, you know, I can understand then the concern. But if you're speaking science, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, white, black, doesn't matter, right? You ought to be able to teach your science.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably something that's important for us to discuss in terms of principles of academic freedom. They're not, the principle doesn't say that you can say whatever you want. If you're a physics professor, you're supposed to teach physics in your class. But as long as you're staying within those boundaries, there really should be no restriction, certainly on your political opinions outside. And I think something that's very significant about this case, not only was I going to speak about something unrelated to these moral, philosophical, political opinions, but also the opinions I was expressing are extremely mild and centrist and supported by 3/4 of Americans. And so it's not like I've even said anything mildly controversial to normal people. When I talk to people from my church and say what happened, they don't even understand why there was a controversy. And so I think that's important to understand how far the trip lines have moved that can set off one of these cancellation attacks.
And do you find that there'll be a new phenomenon? Because I'm finished with the college application process for the 4 older ones. My next one is sophomore, so I have a little bit of time. Do you find parents are taking into account now in terms of universities where they think their child will get a well-rounded, free, non-indoctrination education, or has that not caught up to the college search process?
I hope they are, and anyone who's interested in that can go to the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE, free speech rankings for colleges. So they just have a ranking from 1 to N of all the big universities and colleges in the country in terms of the ability of students to express themselves freely as reported by the students and the policy framework that's in place for ensuring that ability.
Yeah, look, as a parent, and tuition these days can cost a fortune, I want to know that my child is going into a place where they could learn, grow, understand, meet all sorts of people, hear all sorts of opinions, become either firmer and stronger in the opinions they then have, or learn that maybe those opinions are perhaps incorrect and learn some other opinions. I don't want them sitting in a classroom afraid to speak, afraid that they'll get a C or fail a course because a professor thinks that they have to think a certain way. And I think I think the tuition dollars may end up voting in a certain way. At least I certainly hope so.
Yeah, we can hope for that. And then the other thing that people can do, if you are an alumnus or alumna of an institution, you can call them up and tell them, I'm not going to donate anymore unless you ensure academic freedom and political neutrality of the institution. At the University of Chicago, we have the Chicago Principles for Academic Freedom and what's called the Calvin Report, which guarantees that the university as a corporate body won't take positions, political and social issues of the day. And so you can ask for these sorts of documents to be adopted. And if you're any citizen, you can call your lawmaker and say, this is something I care about. You know, can we look into how we can ensure that the funding we give to these institutions is going to scientific research that's non-ideological, where the practitioners of the science are selected based on their scientific merit, not based on other criteria.
I think we could talk about this thing for hours. I recognize that we really just scratched the surface on this, but let me ask as a last question for now. If you were sitting in front of 4,000, 8,000, whatever it is, students in college of all universities, you know, Princeton, Chicago, a new university may be run by the professor who resigned from Berkeley, let's call them the open-minded, and then MIT, everybody, right? What would your message be to those students who, you know, of course they're there because so many people go to college, they want to have fun, they want to learn, but what's your takeaway message for them to understand the world in which they live in and how they should really look at things from the perspective that we discussed over the past half hour or so?
I think what's called epistemic humility, what's sometimes called epistemic humility, approach the world as if you don't know all the answers. Talk to people you disagree with, see how they think about things, be generous with them, criticize and argue rationally, but be generous in terms of their motivations and where they're coming from, and try to see if you can remain open and understand the world better rather than just trying to attack the other side. That's what I would say.
Yeah, look, understand the world better. It's one of the key messages I give to my kids. And the only way you do it is by talking to everybody, listening to everybody. Professor Abbott, thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your courage. Hope the experience was even a learning experience for you. And I really appreciate it. Good luck with everything.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you. Hi, it's Jason Greenblatt on The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek. Maybe I'll sum up this discussion with Professor Abbott with one word. Scary. Yep, it's scary to me to think that there are professors who are afraid to speak about their own topics. This isn't even topics unrelated to the courses that they were hired to teach. Even more scary to me to think that there are students sitting in classrooms afraid that their grade is going to be affected because they think a certain way, because they say certain things publicly. Afraid for university students who can't really have open and honest conversations in some universities or maybe within some universities. The only way really to learn, grow, experience, and help make the world a better place is by airing opinions. I do that all the time now on the show. I did it all the time at the White House. We can't be afraid of listening to other opinions. I think our own convictions can get stronger. We may realize we're wrong about certain things. We may become more appropriately open-minded when we hear other points of view. So I think it's a scary time. I think it's a scary time in society and in particular on university campuses. I really appreciated Professor Abbott's remarks. I think this conversation could have gone on for hours and encourage people to get into these conversations. Parents, students, think about it when you're applying for universities. You know, think about what you're paying for in terms of college tuition. Think about the impact on society and the workplace. I hope you found the conversation interesting and informative. If you do, please share it on my other podcasts with your friends, family, and colleagues. Don't be afraid to share it. You can listen to The Diplomat on Apple, Spotify, wherever podcasts can be heard. My name is Jason Greenblatt. This is The Diplomat, brought to you by Newsweek.
1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.